Okay, let's go to pensions.
I think that's why they use all these.
Yeah.
Oh, pensions.
Yeah, it's just
so exciting.
I don't think anybody has to.
Oh, it's going to be exciting. No, no, somebody said this won't be exciting.
All right.
That was,
the last time I was here, I left my adapter plug in there. I opened it up this morning. It was still
one generator.
Oh, okay, good. I got it back. Yeah.
How long ago was that?
4.5 pages.
The last ASAP?
Last ASAP, maybe.
A lot of people are very honest around here. They just don't like your plug.
Either that or they don't use this very often.
Whatever is the
per whatever, okay. Per hour?
That's a pretty good.
That's
for
pretty
me,
good.
Per page.
And you're in the same spot as you were?
Whatever, yeah,
how long
so
you ran
on. I wouldn't even look there, right?
You might as well just leave it again. And then
yeah, I know. So
you
carry it around the world. Spot.
Sometimes I get this.
Probably got a little page.
In the travel center. I've got that.
Although it's partly there's an element. There's two.
Hello? Thank you, Hans.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. Pension benefits that depend on asset returns is a narrow scope research project designed to consider only those pension benefits that depend wholly or partly on asset returns. The expected output of this research project is evidence to help the board decide whether to undertake standard setting to develop proposals for targeted amendments to IAS 19, employee benefits. The purpose of this paper is to obtain feedback from ASAF on the approach we are exploring in this research project. Paragraphs 4 to 8 of the paper discuss the scope of the research project. The scope of the project is defined in terms of types of benefit, not types of plan. We are not investigating other aspects of benefits or plans such as higher of guarantees or other features of hybrid plans. Paragraphs 9 to 12 of the paper discuss the application of the current model in IAS 19 to pension benefits that depend on asset returns. Those paragraphs explain how a measurement inconsistency arises for this type of benefit. Paragraph 13 to 18 discuss the approach we are exploring in the research project. Under that approach, for pension benefits that depend on asset returns, the rate of return on asset used in estimates of those benefits would not exceed the discount rate applied to those benefits. If our research establishes that the approach being explored would not be feasible, then we expect to recommend that the board perform no further work on pensions. Page 5 of the paper lists a few questions for ASAF that will be discussed in turn. Firstly, do you have any questions or comments on the approach described in paragraphs 13 to 18 of the paper?
Andrew.
Well, we appreciate the project on this issue, which is an important issue for Europe, and EFRAG has its own research project. We hope to publish a discussion paper quarter one of next year. Decisions are yet to be taken, but based on the current situation, we expect that EFRAG's discussion paper will include the capped asset return approach, but also two other approaches, which we're tentatively calling fair value and fulfilment value. So that will be a further source of input alongside some other approaches to bring back to the table at a future date. Regarding initial reactions to your paper, I think first of all, we think that there is an issue with the asset return-based promises, with projecting the benefit based on an expected asset return and discounting them back at a different rate, different discount rate. So we do see that as a mismatch, and this seems to address the mismatch. So in that sense, it seems to have the potential to improve the reporting of these types of scheme. Some people think this isn't enough in isolation to make it worth moving forward. And based on our modeling of this approach, alongside the other approaches, you can sort of project the liability on this basis. And if it's very heavily asset dependent and you held the assets, also model what the asset value would be, how that would interact with the liability value, you still get a big difference because of the back-end loading adjustment. And I think certainly some of the people around the EFRAG table would like you to consider the scope and application of the back-end loading adjustment alongside this, but I'd acknowledge that would be quite a significant expansion of the project and getting into what you might see as some fundamentals of the projected unit credit method, and I understand the desire to keep this to a potential narrow scope or relatively simple fix, but no doubt that will come back. Regarding the scope, I know has bedeviled this whole long-running endeavour to improve the accounting for hybrid pension schemes. So I think the way you're coming at the scope this time is quite neat, actually, to focus on a particular element of the benefit rather than try to capture a particular population of schemes, which is also going to be very, very difficult. In that said, there's still a little bit of confusion about not the types of scheme, that, well, whether a particular type of scheme would be affected or not. So one of the examples we discussed are the typical employer schemes in Belgium, which are basically defined contribution, except the employer is liable for a minimum return guarantee. And because of that, there are normally restrictions on the fund the contributions are invested in, but nonetheless, they are the employees' fund. So if you apply defined benefit accounting to that, you do need to project an expected return on the investment, although it's not actually explicitly stated in the company's promise, which is to make a defined contribution subject to a minimum return. So does that bring you into the scope of this proposal? Would the calculation be affected or not by this proposal? So I think there's a maybe you've already looked at this type of issue, but just looking at the paper, it wasn't entirely clear whether this was broader or wider in its application. But overall, I encourage you to move forward with it. It's worth exploring.
Can I just comment on Andrew's point there? We haven't looked at it in detail yet, but one of the attractions to us of this approach is we think the scope is kind of self-defining, because if the way you're measuring the benefit is based on some assumptions about what the benefit's going to be, and that benefit's based on the assets, then if that asset return is going to be more than discount rate, you're going to be in the scope. If it's below the discount rate, you're not going to be in the scope anyway. So that was very attractive given the previous history.
It talks also about specified assets.
Yeah.
So again, what exactly, and then this is a detailed point that you can look at down the track, but again, in the sort of Belgian scheme example, is being invested in a fund or a range of funds where the employee might have no choice or some limited choice. Does that amount to specified assets?
Again, I think it's specifying in a way, because when you're trying to measure the benefits, you're trying to project what the cash flows are going to be. So somehow you're going to have to estimate what those cash flows are. And if the way you estimate them is based in some way on the pension promise and returns on assets, then you're going to be captured.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Noble?
Yes, thank you. We had two questions, but I think the first one was answered by Peter now. We were a little bit concerned when we said that the scope would be determined automatically. We weren't sure what that really meant. And I think the problem we had in the past was that the scope or the definition of these types of plans was the most difficult part of the issue. So, but I think I have a better idea now. The second is that I think this problem arises when the asset return rate and the discount rate is different. And this time, I think we're looking at only one side and saying when asset return rate is higher than the discount rate, but wasn't sure why you would ignore the other side and if you had any rationale for that.
It's partly because that was the biggest problem. It's partly because when this is going on, people tend to be investing in things that expect higher returns and have higher risk. So that's where this economic mismatch is most pronounced. And it's partly because, and one of the reasons we went for this approach was we didn't want to define what the discount rate is. That's a difficult and quite controversial question, exactly what the discount rate should be. And that's why it's expressed as a cap. Because if you've gone above the cap, you know there's a mismatch. This gets rid of that piece of the mismatch without having to define positively what the discount rate is in absolute terms.
So Just one of the concerns we had was that some plans just simply invest in government bonds when you have to discount it at high quality corporate bonds, and there is a mismatch in the pattern that you actually ignore. So,
yeah, and that's a different question. We're not trying to get into those questions because that would take us a long time, I think.
we support this view, and just going to give you another argument to eliminate this mismatch. Because if the liabilities depend on the assets, and you actually do the opposite, which is use a long-term curve of interest rates, a current term structure of interest rates, what you are actually doing is some sort of marking to market those liabilities. Imagine that interest rates is the main element, which makes no sense in this kind of arrangement, because you cannot prepay then. You cannot settle that in advance. So this is any gain or loss resulting from changes in interest rates don't make any economic sense. But you're going to say, well, I have a profit now, I have a super, or I have a deficit. That doesn't make any sense, because you have to carry those into payment of their liabilities to the people involved in that. Do you know my point? See my point?
Well, I think we're not trying to get into general questions about which rate to use or what to do with long terms. All we're trying to do is eliminate what we think is a clear economic mismatch.
I'm in favor of that. I'll give you an argument. If you don't do that, you're going to end up having another problem, which is some sort of mark-to-market of liabilities in this kind of scheme that doesn't make any sense.
Eliminated an accounting mismatch, not economic mismatch?
Sorry, yes, I meant an accounting mismatch.
Chris?
Thanks, Hans. So just to reiterate, following on from previous conversations, this isn't a huge issue in Asia, so we haven't got the same scope of issue, so just remembering these points are in that context. There was some concern about whether or not this project was actually... What is the real scope of what you're going to be addressing? Is it actually worth standard-setting activity? So in the spirit of always answering three questions rather than the one we've been asked, so there was some concern that there would be some unintended consequences of going down this path. So, for example, in Australia, and it wasn't quite clear where that scope was going to be. So a couple of points. We've found out that there's some schemes that actually have smoothing of interest based on average of plans, etc. So would they be captured in this? So that wasn't particularly clear. And I think the second real concern was about, because this is not tied to the type of fund, it's based on a particular transaction, the question then becomes, how consistent is this then across the entire fund? And so there was some concern that you can have this type of accounting for this type of transaction, but we haven't actually addressed the bigger issue, which was the higher of guarantees. Mm-hmm. And so there was uneasiness about what this was actually going to do to the end outcome. So we also had one country who also indicated that they were concerned about the proposal in the sense of they could understand rationale for looking at assets that were controlled by the entity, but were concerned that if you expand that out to assets that weren't controlled by the entity, how appropriate is that to reflect that in the liability, which is the entity's own liability? So that was some of the major concerns from the region.
Can I maybe just respond on those? So I think the first is the smoothing type plan. We haven't looked at that specifically. It's probably worth us having a look at that. I mean, off the top of my head, it seems like it probably should work, but we should have a look, I think. I think the question of the guarantees, I mean, clearly one of the things we need to look at is if there is any unexpected consequence of just addressing this piece and not the guarantees. Initially, we hadn't thought there was, but I think we need to look at it a bit more. In terms of whether the assets are actually held, the mismatch that arises, the accounting mismatch, as Mary correctly corrected me, is to do with the fact that you're looking at estimates of return, mm-hmm. and then discounting at a rate that's not consistent with the characteristics of that. So whether you actually hold the assets or not is completely irrelevant. That inconsistency exists regardless of whether you hold the assets. I think it becomes more visible and it becomes magnified if you actually hold the assets as well. It's even worse, but it's not reliant on you having the assets. And the solution is not dependent on whether you have the assets.
One E.
Well, in Korea, the number of hybrid products are very limited, so we don't have much issue around this. So this project wouldn't have much significant impact. However, we support this project because we know that hybrid products are quite common in some jurisdictions. And we don't see pension benefit plans that depend on asset returns, but we agree that the capital ultimate cost adjustment model could be helpful in addressing the measurement inconsistency. And just as Chris mentioned, I don't have a clear understanding of the situation where the entity doesn't have the assets when they only use those assets as a reference point. You just mentioned that there is no difference between the two cases, but I just want you to elaborate on this point further.
So let's say the expected return on your assets is 8%. So you're projecting a benefit that's based on an 8% return on the assets, and your discount rate is 5%, let's say. The problem is that the 8% is assuming a return on some kind of risky asset, and an economic rate that makes sense with an 8% return isn't a 5% rate. And so what you're doing is you're picking up a difference of 3% per year, which is really just it's a pure creation of the measurement. It's not really any sort of economic event. And so that's really regardless of whether the whether you actually hold the assets, because the liability is varying with those assets. Right. And you're assuming a return on those assets that drive the benefit return.
So if an entity has other assets other than the reference assets, doesn't the entity have the obligation to pay the promised return from the other assets?
Well, it's going to depend on the facts. So if the facts are that the benefit that's paid depends on particular reference assets, then that's what you're going to be using today in your projections of the cash flows. So today, in my example, you would be projecting 8%, regardless of which assets you're invested in. And that's why the scope is sort of self-limiting, because it depends on what the benefit promise is.
Patrick?
First of all, I think that yes, this is an important problem, and thank you for trying to address it. Second, I have hesitations because in the case that you describe, well, maybe second, situations are really as simple as the one you put in the paper. You have complex, you have guarantees, as was explained, you have caps, floors, and things like that. So the interaction with other guarantees, for me, is an element, and therefore the analysis in depth of each and every pension plan is, for me, paramount. Now, if we take the simple examples as a basis, you have two ways to do it. One is to cap the expected rate of return to the discount rate, which is the one that you seem to envisage. Well, the other one would be to discount at the expected rate of return to avoid the mismatch. In any case, you need to avoid the mismatch. Your solution is interesting. It's one of the two. The other one would not solve everything, because when, and this is the other point which I wanted to make, when the plan or the employer has the assets in a portfolio of assets, then you have another mismatch, which I don't think you offer a solution to in this paper at this stage. Am I right?
And the assets would be at fair value.
Yes, we're not going to. Which creates maybe a requirement for further consideration on this specific mismatch.
Yeah.
Like some sort of VFA approach or something like that?
Yeah, I think, I mean...
But VFA approach does, you know, no, but making sure that you have a symmetry between the evolution of the portfolio of assets and the pension obligations.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think, like, regarding the point about other aspects of the benefit arrangement, impact on guarantees and the interaction of what we're considering with those aspects of the benefit arrangement, that is something that we do need to look into. Yeah. And thank you for bringing that up.
We acknowledge
that. And we're not going to achieve perfect symmetry with this if we do go ahead, but we think it might get a better degree of symmetry regarding the comments on the value of plan assets being at fair value. We think it will perhaps get a better degree of symmetry, but we won't be getting to fair value.
Okay, to be explored.
Yeah.
The last comment which I wanted to make is when the plan or the employer does not have the assets, then we create I think a bigger problem. It's easier to have a matching when you have assets and obligations, but when you have not the assets, you are just using a reference of a pool of assets that you do not own.
Right.
In fact, the money is invested into your own business.
Yeah.
To oversimplify it. So what is the expected return for future pensionee is clear, but the expected return for the entity is not clear. So you are creating a business model combination of factors which is difficult, because in theory, I think that reminds me of the pension plan of Anderson at some point in time, which was invested into Anderson, I think, and which created the problems that we all know.
It was Enron. Enron reinvested themselves.
Oh, when Ron, maybe. Yeah. So, sort of things. So it means that just to make it simple and create serenity on the problem. So on that basis,
serenity.
What do you do? In theory, you have some sort of a bet. You get a better return investing the money of the future pensioners into your own business with an internal rate of return that is higher than what the market can offer.
Mm-hmm.
But then you'd create a risk. So in this case, you don't have an apparent mismatch, but you have a terrible economic mismatch, possibly.
Could I ask Patrick?
Yeah?
Just Patrick, a question about your fact pattern. Are you asking about a situation in which, so you say, the employer does not hold the reference to assets?
Exactly.
Okay, so that means that you're saying, in effect, it's invested in the business, as opposed to a situation in which the employer might reference, let's say, a market index, for simplicity, but actually holds securities issued by its own business in the plan. So what I'm trying to distinguish is if you're saying, basically, it's an unfunded it's not segregated assets.
Exactly. You don't have segregated assets as a counterpart of your obligations. And in this case, the economic decision on the mismatch is, you don't have a mismatch. It's not apparent, yeah. But you have a risk.
Certainly you have a risk. I think it's an interesting observation and analysis about where the risks are buried in a business. And in this case, what risks, in effect, the employees, the pensioners, are being asked to take. But it doesn't fit into the situation that I think the staff is trying to scope.
No, I know, but I am just adding this situation, because in this case, I think you need to drill down further. Do we satisfy ourselves that we discount, in this case, mm-hmm. the obligations to the future pensionees on the basis of a rate of return that is capped on the basis of secured bonds, which we do not own, in which case we are protecting, and whatever is extracted from the business in addition to that is falling to profit.
But I think when some of the feedback, I think that is another potentially problematic area, but I think if you see all these things as related, does that lead you to say, I don't think you should do something of only this limited scope if you're not going to answer these other things?
Okay, but you are saying this measurement inconsistency arises regardless of whether the specified assets are actually held by the plants or by the employer.
Yeah.
I'm saying the situation where you do not hold the assets is more complex.
Oh, it is, but if you see these other inconsistencies, you know, when in other situations in which you don't hold the assets, then does that make you say, unless you can answer all of these, you shouldn't do a limited scope project? Because you said at the beginning you thought it was an important project.
At this stage, I would test the robustness of the solution on this other case.
Okay.
Yes.
I was going to say something similar to Mary. If I understand it correctly, and I'm looking at the staff to make sure I don't misspeak, our aspirations here are pretty modest.
Yes.
We're saying it's clear to us that there's a disconnect.
Sorry to open up the box.
There's a disconnect with it. It's important, though. There's a disconnect in the liability measurement itself. It's internally inconsistent.
Yes.
Wouldn't it be a good idea to reduce that internal inconsistency? That doesn't mean we're going to address differences between how assets are measured and how that liability is measured, but we think in isolation just addressing that would be a good thing to do, given it seems odd to have that inconsistency.
But Sue, it makes economic sense and accounting sense if you hold the assets, and if your assets have a return of 5%, you know, you obviously have an obvious mismatch. If you don't have assets, what is the mismatch?
The fact that the numbers that we're using in the numerator don't match those in the denominator, so we've just got an odd calculation.
We have a theoretical mismatch with nominal assets, if I may say so, a nominal reference. So test the robustness,
I'm not sure. No. I think it's just a mathematical mismatch. If I can make it neutral, I don't think anywhere else in arithmetic you'd have such a disconnect between what you put in the numerator and what you discount by, and I think that was all we were trying to address.
At its simplest level, you've got a calculation that's performed by the actuaries. They're projecting forward using one assumption, then it's discounted back using an assumption regarding return, regarding bond rates that's different. And can we remove that inconsistency? We know that there may be other aspects of pension accounting that won't be helped by this, but you know, our question is, you know, would this help if we do this? And if it wouldn't, then that's when we put pens down. But we're just trying to understand: would it help if we address this in isolation? Would it cause problems elsewhere in the calculations?
And we think we can address it quickly and simply without touching other things. Mm. And if we need to touch other things very much, then we won't do it. That's the proposal.
I'm not in the practical dimension of a minor change or a bigger change. I think we need to think twice on this topic, because if we cap the expected returns to the discounting rate, maybe we introduce a risk. I'm just saying that.
Could you just elaborate on that?
We don't know what will be the return. In the case we are, quote-unquote, the actuaries are sure that the 5% will be delivered by the pool of assets, which is never sure, but that's the assumption. That's your assumption. In this case, yes, you have too much. You discount too much, therefore you have too big. You don't discount enough. You have too big a liability. That's the point at the moment. Mm-hmm. So if you do it the other way, without knowing if you are sure of your 5%, what do you do? Okay, I'm just opening this. Please test the robustness of your solution in the case you don't hold the assets.
Yeah. I mean, it was
directly or indirectly.
And specifically, we are exploring with stakeholders, and we'll continue to explore, does this remove a liability that should be there? Are there impacts on the measurement of the guarantee? So we are exploring that. And
because, in fact, in the case you do not hold the assets, you as a company are taking the risk. And therefore, the expected return which is promised, you either deliver or do not deliver. You don't have the assets to deliver it. You take the risk. So in which case, I am asking myself if you should not distinguish between the two sets of situations. Sorry.
Thanks.
I'm finished.
Thank you.
Chris?
So I guess it's sort of just building on, but perhaps not quite the same as what Patrick was saying, is I think it sparked it because, Sue, your comment was, what we're trying to do here is fix a mathematical issue. Yep. I think if you explain it that way, you actually run the risk that people then say, well, why don't you open up and have another think about what the actual appropriate discount rate is? Because it's a very arbitrary discount rate that you have, which is either government bonds or return on corporate bonds. And so there's a whole lot of other discussion, I think, which you could usefully have about what is the right discount rate. So I think if you're going to do this, then you need to be very careful how you explain it, because I think people are going to say you've opened it, and therefore once you open it, it means you really need to think about bigger issues, which is sort of Patrick's point, yeah. I think.
I was just... unfortunately, I think in our new room, if you're listening from outside the building, it's really clear, but in the room it's really hard to clear here, so if everybody could speak up, it would be good.
I'll set a good model, because I'm always loud.
Which is, we can use you as the benchmark.
Yeah. I don't know you want to on loud. I think it's important... As we talk about this potential project, for some of the reasons that both Chris and Patrick have been citing, to recognize that what I think the staff is focused on is when the explicit promise to employees is based on return, as opposed to the return itself that the fund gets. Because as soon as you start talking about the return and that's the whole can of worms that Chris was just referring to in terms of people, when people would argue about mismatch between the expected return and whether the employer would then adjust the benefits. This is focused on a situation in which the promise to the employee is required to be calculated based on a specific return. Mm-hmm. So so when you go, Patrick, to your unfunded instance, yes, whether it's funded or unfunded, the employer has a risk. It might be amplified if they put some leverage in there. But the point of the mathematical mismatch that Sue was referring to is it's the determination of the amount promised to the employee explicitly, rather than an assumption that ultimately the amount the employee gets is going to be impacted by returns generally.
Mm. Paul.
Thank you. I'm probably going to repeat some of the things that have already been said. We're supportive of the direction of the project. And to the specific question, I think in terms of the narrow example that's been provided, the proposed capping approach does actually meet the objective. So I think it's worth exploring. I do, however, think there are two risks, which I think the discussion that's followed has highlighted. The first one, which is the point I think that Chris was making, which is it does seem counterintuitive that you've got an accounting mismatch, and what we're doing is the side of the mismatch that perhaps has greatest validity to it in terms of how you would make the projection, you're capping that one but keeping the other one the same. Now, I know the reason why you're not proposing to open up the discount rate as part of the process, but I do think it opens us all up to criticism for, well, you've got a daft accounting standard, and what you're actually doing is making it more abstract from reality. So I do think it's a real risk. The other risk, which I think has been highlighted to some degree by Andrew, but even more by Patrick, which is it immediately starts opening up people to all of the other challenges within pension accounting and how you hold the line between this very, very narrow amendment that you're seeking to make. And, well, hang on a minute, there's some mismatches here and there's a bit more complexity here. And all of a sudden, you're unpeeling the onion. So I think there's some challenges here in keeping it narrow-scoped.
Can I just comment on the point about whether the adjustment is in the discount rate or the cash flows? Because that's related to the scope question we had earlier. Because in the scoping, you have to come up with an estimate of the cash flows today already. So you're doing something and it's putting you above the discount rate. So that's putting you automatically in the scope. We don't need to define the scope. If we said we're going to have a different discount rate, then we'd have to define the scope.
I see the problem, but I can see the convenience of the answer, but it's quite hard to argue that it's conceptually accurate.
And I take your point about the communication as well, which we need to look at.
Linda?
So, just a slightly different observation here, supportive of what you're trying to achieve. It occurs to me that as standard setters, the conversation that we're having, the staff never accuses me of being quiet, but anyway, the conversation we're having is very interesting because, like all things, one of the things our board is focused on is can we take things that are quite narrow and have a soundbite aspect to them and try to fix them in a timely basis. Notice the word timely. And as standard setters, we say, well, if you're going to do this, why don't you just do this? And, oh, by the way, how does that analogize over here? And where do you take it over here? So I'm sympathetic.
That was cool.
That said, we're going to pass along some research to you shortly. And my concern, reading through this paper and then looking at the information we're going to send you, is that if you do this, depending on how you articulate it, how many other situations and, you know, slightly different plans are preparers and auditors going to be able to analogize to and just consider that when you're trying to figure out how to articulate it? Because that will happen. And so then I agree that how you communicate this and your rationale for doing this, because even though you think you may have narrowly scoped it or it naturally itself gets narrowly scoped, that's one of the things that you're going to have to deal with in terms of are you accomplishing what you wanted to accomplish. So I commend you for trying to do something that you know needs fixing on a timely basis. And hopefully we can help you with that.
Yu-Chen.
Thank you. Actually, we have some, we consult some stakeholders in China regarding this approach. We appreciate the efforts that the staff made to solve the measurement inconsistency problem, but it seems that the stakeholders are questioning the rationale of the approach, and they have some concerns. The first one is that they think the expected rate of return of assets and the discount rate are totally different. Although under such kind of plan, the amount to be paid in the future is directly linked to the return on assets. However, the expected rate of return on assets depends on the company's operating strategy for the assets, that is the profitability of the assets, etc. But the discount rate of the liability depends on the market risk-free rate of return, which reflects the time value. So in our opinion, these two rates are totally different. The second concern is that according to current IS 19, the discount rate used to determine the present value of the defined benefit obligation is generally based on the interest rate for high-quality corporate bonds. But in the countries where there is no deep market in such bonds, the market yields on government bonds should be used. So assuming a very extreme case that, for example, in a jurisdiction that there is no deep market in such kind of corporate bonds. So each company will use the rate on government bonds to be the both the expected rate of return of assets and the discount rate. So it's very confusing because different company, they hold different assets, but all the expected rate of return are the same. So it would be the readers of the financial statement would be confused. So that's our two concerns based on our discussion with the stakeholders. And the stakeholders provide two suggestions. The first one is similar to the paragraph 17 in this paper that is applying paragraph 115 of IAS 19. The fair value of those insurance policies is deemed to be equal to the present value of the defined benefit obligation. The other suggestion, they suggest another alternative, which is very similar to Patrick's suggestion. Patrick just mentioned that you have two ways to do so. One is the expected rate is equal to the discount rate. And on the contrary, we can also use the... So you are suggesting using the discount rate as the expected rate of the return, and the stakeholders suggest using the expected rate of return as the discount rate. So that's two ways. Yeah, so that's it. Thank you.
Andrew.
Thank you. I'll be brief and loud. So, several ASAP members have commented on the possibility of adjusting the discount rates rather than adjusting the projected return in calculating the liability. I don't think that's going to work, for the reasons that Peter said, but I'll articulate it slightly differently. Most plans that feature some form of asset-based return, that's part of a composite promise. And if you adjust the discount rate, you'll be discounting all elements of the promise at this adjusted discount rate, not just that part of the promise that relates to asset returns. That will create an enormous cliff edge effect, which will bring us right back to this point you made about having to define a particular population of schemes that has proved impossible to date. So I think if this quite neat approach of trying to focus on just an element of the projection calculation is going to survive, then you have to stick with adjusting, capping the asset return part of the calculation, not on the discount rate. And I just reinforce the comments made by a number of members about the need for clear communication. But I think Mary described the scope as schemes that make an explicit promise of an asset-based return to the employees. But I don't think that's quite right. I think it's actually an explicit part of the calculation. And coming back to my example of the Belgian scheme, which is DC plus a guarantee, there's nothing in the pension promise stated to employees that refers to an asset-based return. It's just in applying IAS 19, you do actually, in fact, in the projected unit credit method, have to include that in your estimation. So getting the communication very precise is going to be key.
Ross?
So I agree with the philosophy that Linda has, that this is a good thing to research, and I wish you luck on researching it and keeping it narrow. And the reason for that, I'm happy, Peter, if you want to call Peter Persakis at the FASB and get the research. We have tried twice since I've been at the board to look at accounting for what we call in the U.S. as cash balance pension plans. And in essence, what the problem in the U.S. is the expected benefit and the discount rate don't match. And so what you end up in sometimes is a liability recorded on companies' books that is less than what is the liability that's provided at any point in time to the employee. It's confusing, and people wonder if that's really the liability. In both times, the board decided that it was not possible to do a targeted amendment, and we'd have to look at changing the discount rates or changing some aspect of the measurement philosophy. And the board decided that we had other things that were more important to do, and we dropped the project. But we've done extensive research, the extensive files. If you'd like to review them and see, and if you can come with a great idea, I'm sure we'd love to copy it because it is something that does need to be resolved. What's that?
With the copyright?
No, we won't pay him any money for it. We'll just copy it.
You'll tell your files.
Well, that all sounds very promising. Yeah. Yeah, pun intended, yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a break. There should be break.
3:15.
Yeah.